Case number 08-7101, City of Harper Woods Employees Retirement System, derivatively on behalf of Bar Systems PLC, appellant versus Richard Dick L. Olver et al. Mr. Isaacson for appellant, Mr. Byrne for appellees.
May it please the court, I am Eric Allen Isaacson, counsel of record for the City of Harper Woods Retirement System, the plaintiff and appellant in this matter. A case which I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if I may. The case is one which raises issues concerning the rule of Foss versus Harbottle, a rule that comes from an English decision of 1843 that establishes the rule that in a suit to assert the rights of a corporation, ordinarily the corporation should be the party plaintiff. Now, Foss versus Harbottle indicates that there are exceptions to this rule, and the exceptions to the rule are the derivative suit, and the basis of our federal Rule 23.1 and the District of Columbia's Rule 23.1. The question in this case, first and foremost, is whether a scheme to pay bribes is something that would qualify as an ultra vires or illegal act that cannot be ratified by a majority of the shareholders. As a matter of English law is how the district court decided the case. I think that the district court erred as a matter of English law. If the district court was right about the English law, I believe that the public policy of the District of Columbia would mandate application of local law. But I'd like to start by pointing out what I think is the error in the district court's holding with respect to English law. Quite frankly, we've got the expert declaration of Paul Girolami, who cites seven treatises indicating that serious violations of public law come within the exception to the rule of Foss versus Harbottle because they cannot be ratified. We've got an Irish decision from 1915, which, as a practical matter, is on all fours with the case. It's a case, Cockburn versus Newbridge Sanitary Steam Laundry Company, a case where the managing director, Mr. Llewellyn, was paying bribes in order to get the get contracts, get business from the War Office. And the master of the rolls, O'Brien, dismissed the case, saying it's barred by the rule of Foss versus Harbottle. On appeal, the Court of Appeals unanimously held that the rule of Foss versus Harbottle indisputably applies, but so do its exceptions. And this case came within the exceptions because it would be impossible for a majority of the shareholders to ratify a scheme of paying bribes in order to obtain business.
Is it a scheme of paying bribes, or is it an inability to ratify an unlawful act? They're different.
Well, it's an inability to ratify an unlawful act that is offensive to basic principles of public policy.
Well, let's do the unlawful act first. My intuition, if I'm remembering my preparation of this case, is the exception is you can't ratify an unlawful act.
That's right.
Okay. So we first need to know whether or not all bribe-giving would be unlawful, right?
Well, we've alleged that this bribe-giving is unlawful both under British law and under American law, including the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. And there was a serious frauds office investigation in England that was ultimately terminated for reasons unrelated.
You agree the focus is it has to be with respect to an unlawful act, right?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So we're not floating off into public policy or offensive behavior or whatever. It's an unlawful act.
We're talking about
your claim is it's an exception because you cannot ratify an unlawful act.
Yes, Your Honor. Now, the difficulty would be if somebody were to file a lawsuit, a shareholder of United Parcel Service, for example, were to file a lawsuit seeking to recover on behalf of the corporation money that was paid for parking violations by a UPS driver. Well, were the parking violations an unlawful act? In some sense, yes, they were. I don't think there's any question that that case would be shut down. That is not a case where a shareholder is going to be authorized to sue. We know that if we're talking about United Kingdom law, which is applied in the Cockburn case, we know that a scheme of paying bribes is an unlawful act that cannot be ratified and that warrants a shareholder derivative suit, which was upheld unanimously in that case.
Your complaint was a failure to supervise. Not that the directions committed the directors committed illegal acts themselves.
Well, this is a case where the company was paying bribes, and the directors should have been aware of what was going on.
Cochran, the alleged wrongdoer, was the director who paid the bribes.
Llewellyn was the director who had paid the bribes.
So I'm now trying to hook up what you're alleging with the precedent that you say is on all fours. It's not on all fours. Your complaint is a failure to supervise.
My complaint in this case is a breach of fiduciary duty, a failure to supervise, and in all likelihood, a deliberate turning of a blind eye.
Breach of fiduciary duty, criminal, unlawful?
Well, turning a blind eye, I think, is. If you know that your corporation is paying the bribes.
Any all fours precedent on that? A breach of a fiduciary duty is unlawful? Failure to supervise is illegal? So you're moving away from your core theory. That's exactly what I'm trying to understand. You've kind of shifted. You start out with a very strong premise and a case that is on all fours with your strong premise, but that's not what you're complaining about.
The question in Cockburn is whether you have to have a majority shareholder vote to proceed with an action which involves the payment of bribes. In that case, the person who was paying the bribes happened to be a director. Here, the case is whether we have to have a majority or have to have a shareholder meeting to determine whether the corporation shall pursue an action against the executive officers of BAE who were, in fact, implicated in paying the bribes and the directors of BAE.
I got lost a bit ago. So we're talking about. What case are you talking about? I've heard Cochran and Cockburn.
Cockburn versus Newbridge Sanitary. Steam Laundry.
Okay. So, all right, I think it's Coburn, but be that as it may, that's a 1915 Irish case.
1915 Irish case, that's right, Your Honor. It's a case that
is. And there are statements in English courts that post-date that, most recently, I think, in 1988. That do not enumerate the exception that you're proposing here.
Your Honor.
Smith, I think, is the most recent.
Your Honor, there are quite a few cases in English law, but none of them indicates that Cockburn is wrong. Cockburn is cited in the leading English treatises.
Did the cases discuss Coburn? Do they say anything about it at all? The English cases.
The recent ones say very little about it, Your Honor.
So what you've got is a 1915 Irish case,
got a
which has not been incorporated or adopted or ratified or approved in some way by an English court.
And
a 1988 case, among others, in which English courts survey or recount this area of law without enumerating this exception among the others that they do state. That's a fair assessment, isn't it?
Your Honor, it is cited in Halsbury's Laws of England, which is the most authoritative secondary text in English law. It's cited in multiple treatises. The English treatises, you know, all of them, if you look at them, indicate that there is an exception to the rule.
I understand that. I'm sorry, finish that. There's an exception to the rule for.
There's an exception to the rule of Foss versus Harbottle
or
when the lawsuit relates to illegal acts that are violations, serious violations of general law and public policy.
Well, I think they say that cannot be ratified.
It cannot be ratified. And if they cannot be ratified, there's an exception to the rule.
Not everything that's unlawful cannot be ratified, right?
Not everything that's unlawful cannot be ratified.
Some things that are ratified can be lawful.
There are regulatory violations.
We have no real guidance from the English courts as to what's on what side of the line.
We don't have clear guidance from the English courts.
And you have the burden on this point.
Pardon me, Your Honor?
And you have the burden on this point.
I think that I've got the burden of indicating that we come within an exception to the rule of Foss versus Harbottle. I think that the treatises indicate that there's an exception for serious illegal conduct. There's an Irish case from 1915 when Ireland was part of the United Kingdom that applies the rule of Foss versus Harbottle and finds that payment of bribes comes within an exception, so that to seek relief from the person who is paying the bribes does not require a meeting of shareholders and cannot be ratified. The wrongful conduct cannot be ratified by a majority of the shareholders. Here, in this case, we've got payment of bribes, and the question is whether the conduct at issue can be ratified by a majority vote of shareholders.
Have there been no bribes paid by English corporations since 1915? Why are there no cases here?
Not very many cases. One of the cases the defendant cites indicates that there are very few English derivative suit cases, and as a consequence, it looks to American law and adopts the internal affairs doctrine from an American case.
I'm sorry, who said that?
That was the Rolls-Royce case. It was a English judge. And I see I'm running into my rebuttal time.
Well, restore your time. I want to follow up on that. Where is the Rolls-Royce case in your
Rolls-Royce case is cited in my reply brief, Your Honor.
And you have a page following American derivative?
Eight. Yes. The case.
Sure, it's not a former English judge. That seems like a high crime in the United
States. Your Honor, the case is quoted at page 8 of my reply brief, and I quote, The case is Konamamaneni versus Rolls-Royce Industrial Power India Limited, 2002-1 WLR 1269. The quotation, there is no authority in England which is directly on point with respect to internal affairs doctrine, but the question has been considered in the United States, where derivative actions are frequently brought in one state in relation to the affairs of a corporation which have incorporated in another state. And it goes on and follows the American precedents with respect to the internal affairs doctrine. There's no reason to think that...
And what court is it?
Oh, it is an English court, and it's a trial court.
English trial court applying the law of India.
It's an English trial court that applies the law of India by looking to American precedents, determining that the law of India should apply, and then concludes that the substantive law of India is the same as the law of England. But the fact is that English judges do look to foreign courts, Irish courts, and even American courts.
Haven't you made out a strong case for the application of forum non convenes?
I think that's an interesting issue that probably ought to be litigated on remand. It was not decided by the district judge.
Well, I realize that I'm not suggesting that we do it in the first instance, but the more I listen and the nuances, the gaps to be filled, and there's certainly a compelling question there, it seems to me.
There are interesting forum nonconvenience issues. One of the critical questions is in what forum can the parties be served? The parties can be served in the District of Columbia. Another question with respect to forum nonconvenience would be where are the assets that one might be able to collect from?
Well, there are worldwide.
Judgment.
They're a worldwide company, are they not?
Yes, Your Honor.
You could probably serve them in India, couldn't you?
I do not know, Your Honor.
Well, you'd have strong English precedent applying American law.
Right. Thank you, Your Honor.
See you on rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Larry Byrne, and I represent the appellees in this proceeding. Judge Ginsburg, just picking up on your point, I think that probably BAE could be served pursuant to Indian law under Irish service of process under the plaintiff's theory of the case. But the fact is this case rises or falls with the district court's interpretation of English law. Most importantly, the district court had before it a total of 5 declarations from 2 respected English lawyers whose qualifications to opine on English law were never challenged. The Harper Woods retained English law expert and the BAE appellees, defendants below, English expert. And on the key points, those 2 experts do not disagree, and Judge Collier correctly found that. What the plaintiffs are asking, in effect, and if I understand the argument just made, this court should speculate that if permitted to reconsider the issue today, an English court might adopt the American view of derivative suits based on a 1915 Irish decision.
Well, what do you think are the key points that the experts agreed on?
The key points...
That proved to be dispositive on the ratification question.
Yeah. The key points that there is no dispute about, Your Honor, is first of all that England, as a matter of policy and as a matter of legal history, frowns very much on derivative lawsuits. It doesn't mean English law doesn't create other remedies, but it frowns very much on derivative lawsuits, and in that...
Now, just go to the exceptions.
The exceptions...
Where do they agree? What do they agree on?
They agree that there are only 3 exceptions recognized by English courts as opposed to treatises that talk about what might be the better approach to the law. And the 3 exceptions, recognized exceptions by English courts that the 2 experts agree on, is a derivative action can be maintained. Well, first of all, there's 4 points they agree on. It cannot be maintained if the act that is being sued on is ratifiable, and I'll come back to what ratifiable means. Not actually ratified, but ratifiable. 2, if the act is ultra vires, and I'll come back to that because ultra vires in English law is a much narrower concept than it is in U.S. law, then a derivative action can be maintained. 3, if the act could only be ratifiable by a supermajority, then a derivative suit is maintainable by the minority shareholders. And the other exception is where the defendants are alleged to have acted fraudulently for personal profit and are in control of the company. Both experts agree that those are the 3 exceptions, and that in the first instance, if the acts in question are ratifiable by a majority of the shareholders, there is no derivative action and you don't get to the 3 exceptions. There's no dispute about that. What the plaintiff's expert then goes on to say, and which Judge Collier rejected, is there are all these treatises that say the interpretation is too narrow under English law, that it should be broadened, that it should be expanded.
Oh, wait, let's go to ratifiable.
Right.
So what do they agree on with respect to what is and is not ratifiable?
That you think is conclusive? Well, they mix 2 different concepts, Your Honor. It's a question you asked earlier, and I want to address it right now. There is an illegal act, and there's an ultra vires act. And in fact, at the end of the lengthy hearing before the district court, I asked and the district judge agreed that both sides be permitted to submit supplemental declarations from their English law experts, which are in the record below and in your appendix, on the precise question of whether an illegal act is ratifiable by a majority of shareholders under English law. And the answer is yes, it is. And that is how the English courts have interpreted it, and that's how Judge Collier correctly ruled. What, as an issue, is an illegal act.
And your principal authority for that is what?
It's Fosby Harbottle.
Oh, no, not Foss. I mean, the with respect to the ability to ratify an illegal act.
We cite the Prudential case in our brief, which is an English case, not an Irish or a U.S. case. And there are a couple of other cases we cite in our brief on that point. There is not a lot of law.
What was the act in Prudential?
I can give you the citation, Your Honor.
No, no.
It's cited on page 29 of our brief.
And what was the unlawful act?
Take a look at that, and I'll
And I didn't get the experts agreeing on whether shareholders can ratify illegal acts.
I don't think there's a dispute about that if you line up their affidavits next to each other. Where the confusion comes in is the plaintiffs want to say, and the plaintiff's expert tries to say, that an illegal act is an ultra vires act under English law, and that is not the case. And there are two different types of illegal acts that we're talking about. We're talking about illegal acts done by the corporation and illegal acts done by the directors of the corporation. The plaintiff's claim here is that the current and former directors of an English company, BAE PLC, breached their fiduciary duties to the shareholders and wasted corporate assets. That's how they styled their complaint. That's what Judge Collier found she was considering. Those acts by the directors are clearly ratifiable by a majority of the shareholders under English law. They can hold a vote and they can say, we don't agree, or even if they did breach their fiduciary duties, we're prepared to accept that on behalf of the corporation. That is what English law permits. They're not being asked to vote.
English law would say that if it were true that the directors were causing, were assisting in a pattern and practice of making illegal and improper bribes, false and misleading statements, that could be ratified.
That's not what was alleged, but that could be ratified. In other words, they're not,
the
shareholders are not.
The complaint says, accuses the defendants of causing BAE to engage in a pattern and practice of making illegal and improper payments and of making false and misleading statements. That's why I asked the question. That's exactly what they're complaining
about. Well, but they say that what the harm that results from that is a breach of fiduciary duty to the shareholders. And that's the act of the directors, that even if true, even if the allegation is true, it is ratifiable. The directors, the shareholders are not asking to vote whether paying bribes are legal or not. That's irrelevant to the ratification question. There are separate remedies under English law that govern and punish acts of bribe paying by the corporation. If bribes were paid, even if authorized, as
you're
alleged.
Saying they could ratify a failure to supervise.
Correct.
Could they ratify a policy which just mirrored what I said in the complaint? The directors adopt the policy for pattern and practice of making illegal and improper payments, false and misleading statements to conceal the payments. That's the policy, and now I want shareholders to, can they ratify that?
In that theoretical case, the shareholders could choose to ratify it after the fact. Under English law, that's correct.
Can you just tell me what, I don't know one way or another, what's the English law you're relying on that says, in other words, I want to get rid of your ratification of the failure to supervise, because I want to see just how far you go. I want to go to ratification of a precise unlawful act.
Right. And as Professor, as Mr. Moore explains, as Mr. Girolami explains, both experts, those types of acts are ratifiable by the shareholders.
I'm asking, what's the case?
We cite them in our brief. Give me one second. It is at page. Sorry, I'm in the wrong brief.
Some case it leaps out you, and that's a fairly big proposition. If you can just give me a big one. I just don't recall it. Maybe right. That's an English case?
Yes. And there are several others in the brief. The point is that this is the critical point, and this is the fundamental difference between English law and U.S. law, And U.S. law is a misnomer because, as the court knows, derivative actions in this country are a creature of state law, not federal law. And so there are 51 different derivative causes of action. English law takes the approach, and this was argued at great length before Judge Collier, that wrongs done to a corporation, the rights to fix those wrongs belong to the corporation and should be controlled by the corporation. And there should be very, very narrow circumstances where some other party can step into the shoes of the corporation and assert the rights of the corporation and seek remedies for the corporation. That is a fundamentally different approach than the U.S. style of derivative suits, and it's a conscious approach that has been followed in England for almost 200 years.
Let me go back again, because I'm perplexed. Am I wrong in understanding that the cases that you're pointing to are ratification of failure to supervise, which I'm trying to distinguish out?
First of all, I don't think the plaintiff's case is failure to supervise.
You don't think it's failure to supervise?
No. They allege
what I'm trying to, I'm going to try again. I used what they have in the complaint, and I'm trying to say to you, let's assume the director did it directly.
Right.
Not it was there and there was a failure to control those who were doing it, but the director established the policy of bribery and established the policy of covering up. I am doing it.
Right.
All right. Now, I didn't read your cases to say in that situation that could be ratified. I'm assuming that's unlawful. Now, you're saying your authorities do say that's ratifiable, as opposed to failure to supervise or failure to observe or whatever?
In the context of deciding whether a shareholder can maintain a derivative suit on behalf of the corporation,
right,
under English law, that is ratifiable by the shareholder.
You're saying your authorities support that as distinguished from a failure to supervise.
Correct. And exactly.
So Colburn is an aberration.
Correct. And Judge Collier took supplemental briefing on precisely this point. Both sides submitted affidavits. Again, they're not in great conflict as to what the actual law is. There's conflict about what the proper law should be, might be, how it might have been interpreted, how it might change. But there's no conflict onto what the prevailing interpretation of the English court's view is, as opposed to treatises or what an American court might do. I did want to just briefly touch on two other points and answer any other questions the court may have. This is a derivative action, purported to be a derivative action against an English company. We think that Judge Collier correctly decided that English law should apply, and that therefore under English law the action was not maintainable. She did not address, because there was no need to address, the other arguments the defendants below made, which is the forum non conveniens argument and the personal jurisdiction argument. I think the argument here today highlights the forum non conveniens argument, which this court is free to consider or not, because we're sitting here with dueling experts talking about English law and English policy, although even though the two experts don't really disagree on the fundamental premises that govern this case. Unless there are any further questions.
How do you defend the district courts having dismissed this matter with prejudice?
The fact is, Your Honor, that given the basis of the district court's ruling, which is that this action could not be maintained under English law and none of the exceptions applied, any amendment would have been futile. In other words, it's not a question of they failed to allege enough about bribery or they failed to allege enough about bad policy or bad acts. It's a question of taking everything they say in their complaint as true. They can't maintain this action under English law. There's nothing the plaintiffs could do.
If they could amend their complaint or refile, they may have additional facts sometime.
But not facts that would change this analysis. In other words, if they were to say that there were more bad conduct by the defendants, if they could allege that truthfully, that wouldn't change the analysis of whether the acts are ratifiable or not, or whether the exceptions don't apply. That's the fundamental point of the judge's ruling.
And one of the exceptions you enumerated, and I think as one on which parties agree, is that the defendants may have, if they had acted fraudulently for personal gain and if they control the corporation.
Correct.
Right? Now, why couldn't additional facts in principle come to light that could support that allegation?
Because the record below is undisputed that the directors and officers collectively hold less than 4.5% of the shares of the company, and that the shareholders have the legal ability at any time to call a special meeting and act on ratification.
And the plaintiffs cite evidence that the question of control is meant to be a practical one, not a percentage of shares.
No, the question of control is whether who has the ability to tee up, if you like, the ratification issue. And under English law, a majority of the shareholders have a right to do that. And that's the question of control for purposes of deciding whether a derivative action can be maintained.
So you're saying a majority could do that under English law?
Correct. Okay. And the directors would have no ability to block that action by the shareholders.
The standard that we laid out and repeated most recently in Bellazan, I think, is that dismissal with prejudice is basically the default is not dismissal without prejudice.
Right.
And that there needs to be, I think you may have said this, I'm not sure, basically no plausible way in which it could be repled.
That's correct.
But in that case and another similar case, there was a heightened pleading standard, which we don't have here.
Right, that's true.
The question is, could the facts change or could additional facts come to light? You're saying there are no facts.
No, what I'm saying is, regardless of what the facts are, given the basis of Judge Collier's ruling, there's nothing further the plaintiffs could plead to overcome her interpretation of law. There are no new facts they could introduce that would change the application of English law to this case. And I should point out, Your Honor, that the plaintiffs below never raised or asked for permission to replead. I realize I'm
I
over my...
that, but that's not conclusive. In the
understood, Your
case
Honor.
In Bellazan, we said
right.
That.
But I think the reason they didn't ask to replead is because they recognized quite properly under the judge's ruling that there was nothing additional they could plead that would overcome her ruling. They may disagree with the ruling, but it's not a ruling that gets cured by additional pleading. And just to finish on Judge Edwards' question, Judge, on page 27 of our brief, we cite two additional English cases, Morell and Smith, which stand for the proposition that illegal acts are capable of ratification by the shareholders under English law, and therefore the derivative action is not maintainable by the shareholders. I'm happy to answer any further questions the court has, recognizing I've gone far over my time, for which I apologize.
Thank you, Mr. Byrne.
May it please the court. Smith versus Croft was a case that involved no criminal acts or illegal conduct. It involved executive compensation. We're only lawful contacts within the corporate power, and there's no reason for the court to discuss the exceptions at issue here. The Prudential case was a corporate acquisition that was challenged, that the master of the rolls held he was going to postpone determining whether it came within the exception to Foss versus Harbottle. It was proved that there was a breach of fiduciary duty at trial. The trial judge found that it came within an interest of justice exception. On appeal, the Court of Appeal said, we have no occasion to decide any issue with respect to Foss. We're not comfortable with interest of justice, but as the corporation is willing to take advantage of the judgment entered in its favor, there's nothing for us to decide on the issue here. It's clearly identified as obiter dictum, and the court indicates that very clearly. I've never seen a court more clear about that.
Moral. Is that Prudential?
That was Prudential, Your Honor. Prudential number two, I think, is the citation.
No dictum from a court can be as obiter as a treatise.
Your Honor, I think that you'll see it's an opinion where they say, we thought about doing a written opinion, but that would take too much time. this is a discussion that is almost at the level of colloquy with counsel, quite frankly, and colloquy doesn't have much precedential effect. In this case, we've got claims against people who are executive officers as well as against outside directors, so we clearly have claims against people who are implicated in the bribe-paying scheme. We've also got claims against aiders and abettors. That means, I think, that the case is on all fours with the Cockburn decision, Justice or Judge Edwards, and it is Cockburn. I've got a copy of it in front of me. I also had attached it for the court's convenience to a Rule 28J letter that was submitted yesterday, submitting an additional authority that cites and discusses the case in a paragraph that I'm sorry to say was clearer than my brief was.
That was yet another treatise.
That was another treatise, yes, Your Honor. The treatises are unanimous. Wright and Miller's Federal Practice isn't binding on this court. Blackstone's commentaries on the law of England.
What about Wright and Miller?
Wright and Miller's Federal Practice Treatise isn't binding on this court, but you cite it and follow it all the time. Blackstone's commentaries on the law of England was not binding
on
English.
Now you tell me.
It's not binding on English courts. But English courts follow it all the time. As Girolami points out, the treatises are unanimous. Mr. Moore's response was to say that English treatises are notorious for repeating errors because they all copy from one another. Trust me, he said, not the treatise writers, not the scholars of the law.
But the only case that I've not seen, I had the same problem with the cases cited by the opposition. I'm not sure they're addressing the point as opposed that I'm raising as opposed to criminal acts are not ultra vires, which is a different point than the one I'm raising. I'm trying to figure out whether criminal acts can be ratified. The only case you're citing is Cockburn, and I'm not seeing them to be citing anything, and so you're confirming there's no other case in British jurisprudence that addresses this question?
Well, there's Powell versus Kempton Park Racecourse Company, 1897, 2 Queen's Bench, 242, which involved a shareholder's suit to keep a racecourse company from allowing betting on its premises. The opinion indicates that a shareholder can, in fact, sue to enjoin a corporation from engaging in illegal practices that would have violated the Betting Act of 1853. The court ultimately concluded that the Betting Act had not been violated, but the suit was permitted to challenge the corporate activity. Without a demand on the directors. It and Cockburn are both cited extensively with approval in the English treatises in the absence of a well-developed body of English derivative suit law. The derivative suit cases that they are citing are ones that are dealing with different issues and they don't address these points, and I think that it's clear.
Let me just ask you one other thing, which I'll look at after this hearing, just so I have what you think is your best answer. Where in your complaint do you directly say that this case is about, like Coburn, whatever it is, you are seeking to go after someone precisely for the commission of an unlawful activity as opposed to failure to supervise?
I can't, as I stand here, give you a specific paragraph citation, Your Honor. I'd be happy to submit one if you'd like me to do that.
The treatise that you noticed to the court yesterday.
Yes, Your Honor.
I see it saying the Supreme Court has confirmed in the case of Buchanan Limited versus McBay, Peter Buchanan, that the shareholders acting unanimously cannot ratify conduct of directors which amounts to fraud or dishonesty. Particular case, fraud on the revenue commissioners. But then I don't understand why the next sentence begins ungrammatically with the postpositive, however. However, if the shareholders unanimously forgive the director, it is arguable that no action will lie against the director by the company subsequently. Isn't that the position of your adversary in this case?
Well, if that were the position of my adversary, it would only be arguable and it would be unanimous if the shareholders unanimously forgive the director. And Foss versus Harbottle recognizes an exception where a act or conduct cannot be ratified by a simple majority. If it takes a supermajority, we're in an exception.
So the thrust of this paragraph is the contrast between unanimous shareholders and the majority of shareholders. Is that the point?
Well, if the unanimous, if it is arguable that shareholders at a vote could unanimously consent to a violation, that still puts this case in Foss versus Harbottle's exceptions, because a requirement of more than a majority is one of the exceptions. The case comes from the exception comes from Edwards versus Halliwell. It was a derivative action by a member of a union against the union, objecting, I think, to an increase in union dues, which could be approved only by a supermajority vote. And the
perhaps putting the two of the exceptions together, or one with a codicil, it's if the act is ratifiable by a simple majority.
That's correct.
And you're saying that.
I'm saying that if it could be ratified by unanimous consent, that that's something that would be, because of the requirement of unanimity, would be within an exception to Foss versus Harbottle under Edwards versus Halliwell in the cases that follow and apply it.
Only by unanimous consent.
Yeah, well, that seems what this seems to say. And then it's the following sentence, the rest of the paragraph, that I submitted this for, when it says in Cockburn versus Newbridge, Sanitary Steam Laundry Company Limited, the managing director had caused the company to pay bribes to get contracts. The majority shareholders were in agreement with this. Two minority shareholders instituted a derivative action in the name of the company against the managing director. Having noted that a company could not ratify its own criminal acts, the court ordered the managing director to repay the amount of the bribes. And that would be something that would apply.
It was an action against the director.
It was an action against the director for recovery.
Is this an action against the director?
This includes this includes executive officers of the company. Yes, Your Honor, and it includes.
Insofar as it brought against the company itself, it's not on point with Coburn.
Well, if I'm bringing a derivative action, I have to name the company itself. I think the distinction
puts it in a different posture than the case you're citing.
Well, the distinction you seem to be drawing is that if I also name the outside directors of the company who may not have known about the wrongdoing, it takes the case entirely out of Foss versus Harbottle.
No, I didn't say entirely.
I mean,
as far as you're suing the corporation, which is, of course, where the money is, it may remove that, corporation.
It takes it out of Cockburn. I didn't mean to say Foss versus Harbottle. We're trying to recover the money on behalf of the corporation, Your Honor. We are not suing to recover the money from the corporation. We are suing to recover the money from officers and directors and aiders and abettors for the benefit of the corporation. It's a shareholder derivative suit.
The real defendants in interest are just natural persons?
The corporation is a nominal defendant.
I understand that, but it would not be liable?
PNC Bank is not a natural person. So there are at least that defendant that is not a natural person.
And the Albritons were not directors of the corporation?
That's correct, Your Honor.
But of the bank?
They controlled the bank. That's right, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Byrne.
Isaacson. Thank you.
I'm sorry, Mr. Isaacson. Thank you. Mr. Byrne, thank you as well. The case is submitted.